Good day. Today is Monday, 4th May 2026, and before I proceed with this program, let me remind you again to tick the like button and check your subscription to this channel. If once you watch this program, you decide that you like what you've heard and you wish to indicate this fact. Now, the most intriguing, the most interesting thing that has happened in the world over the last 24 hours is not, in my opinion, the latest statements made by President Trump and the Iranians over the situation in the Strait of Hormuz. That vastly overreported exchange I will discuss towards the end of this program. Rather, it is a report published or produced, apparently, by a European intelligence agency, which has received considerable coverage in parts of the Western media, and which has been published, or at least reported about, by CNN in the United States and by the Financial Times in Britain. Now, the fact that this report by this European intelligence agency has been published by the Financial Times leads me to think that the intelligence agency in question is probably British. I don't know this for a fact. This is a speculation, entirely a speculation on my part. But as we will see, the contents of this report, as it has been leaked to the international media, are fully consistent with the kind of articles and commentaries that have been appearing, especially in the British media over the last few weeks and months, leading me, or rather strengthening me, in an already forming conviction that I had already begun to develop, that there has been a significant information campaign carried out by this particular intelligence agency, probably British intelligence agency, over the last few months, as Ukraine's situation and the situation in the war has deteriorated, especially since the fall of Pokrovsk. So what does this report say? Briefly, it says that the Kremlin is in a state of panic and paranoia, that Putin is frightened of potential coup attempts against him and of possible assassinations, that all sorts of extraordinary precautions are being taken by the Kremlin to protect him against both of these eventualities. The staff of the Kremlin, down to the cooks and the secretaries, are now subjected to relentless, round-the-clock, 24-hour surveillance, including with CCTV and other electronic forms of surveillance. That Putin spends most of his time hiding deep inside bunkers in the Kremlin, in Krasnodar. They're careful not to tell us exactly where in Krasnodar, but Krasnodar, for the record, was where Alexei Navalny and various other people in Russia claimed that a very large building that had been constructed, that had been under construction before the 2008 crisis, and whose construction has never been completed, was actually a palace intended for the personal use of Vladimir Putin himself. For the record, I think that there is conclusive evidence that this was a commercial venture and that the building in question was intended as a hotel, but I'm not going to discuss that further. But anyway, Krasnodar is where Putin is supposed to be lurking, hiding in his lair, various lairs, one of his lairs. Supposedly, he's cut back massively on foreign trips. He's traveling less and less around the country. He's meeting with fewer and fewer people. The Financial Times tells us that he spends 70% of his time on the war, that he's no longer much interested in domestic matters, economic questions, and those sort of things. When he's not discussing matters like the economy, the 30% of his time that is not devoted to the war is taken up with meetings like the supposedly pointless meeting with the visiting president of Indonesia, for example. And that this paranoid, frightened, demoralized Putin has supposedly been shaken by recent assassinations of Russian generals, probably by Ukraine, that there is worry, growing anxiety about Ukraine's drone offensive, and Putin having survived a coup attempt by Prigozhin, Yevgeny Prigozhin, and a dissident faction within the Wagner Group back in 2023, is worried about that all over again. And the person who is apparently suspected of being the potential architect or organizer of the coup turns out to be none other than Sergei Shoigu, the former Russian defense minister, who is now, of course, the secretary of Russia's Security Council. And, well, the report, of which, by the way, of course, I have not seen the original. I'm getting all this information from CNN and from the Financial Times. Well, it continues in that vein. The Russians supposedly deeply rattled and frightened by the Valdai attack and all of that. And all of this paranoia and all of this fear caused by the decline in the Russian economy, the burgeoning financial crisis inside Russia, the wave of dissent that is supposedly spreading through the Russian population, the increasingly critical comments purportedly being made in Russia about Putin online, the signs of some kind of a clampdown in Russia to try to bring all of this dissent under control, and also the fact that the war itself is not going well. There have been setbacks on the front lines. Things are not playing out successfully on the front lines and all of that. So what are we to make of all of this? Well, there's a number of things, first of all, to say. Some of the actual facts in this report are true, but they are, in fact, of very long standing. So Putin himself revealed in an interview he gave to Pavel Zarubin, his favourite journalist, which was reported in the Russian media, extensively reported in the Russian media, and which was published on Russian television, that since the start of the special military operation, presumably for security reasons, he has basically moved permanently into the Kremlin, that he spends his nights in his Kremlin apartment, and the rest of his time he works at his desk in the Senate Palace in the Kremlin. So This is true, but it is also long-standing. It has been the case over the last 4 years that this is so. That the fact that the Russians do conduct careful monitoring of people who work in the Kremlin, the security in the Kremlin is very tight, is true, but then it has always been true, and no doubt security has been tightened since the start of the special military operation, but that is completely unsurprising. The fact that Putin and other senior officials are very restricted in the use of mobile phones, and Putin himself doesn't have one. Well, that again has long been known because of the ease of hacking mobile phones by hostile governments, which again is well known, and Putin himself many years ago, about 10 years ago, confirmed this. The fact that the Kremlin avoids using electronic means to generate particularly sensitive classified documents, that in fact some Kremlin documents for additional security are hand-typed on old mechanical typewriters. Well, that was revealed way back in the aftermath of the Edward Snowden allegations. So a lot of this is true, but as I said, it doesn't mean exactly what the authors of this report appear to want it to mean, because it simply reflects security precautions that are a very long standing. The idea that Sergei Shoigu, of all people, can be the mastermind of some kind of a coup against Putin is utterly fantastic. Shoigu is a personal friend and a loyalist from everything that we know about him. He's absolutely not the sort of person to plot a coup against Putin. Putin did move him from his position as defense minister, but gave him a very senior position as secretary of Russia's Security Council. And in that position, Shoigu does not have access to the levers that would be necessary to organize a coup. Just saying. The article says that Shoigu still has contacts within the Russian Defense Ministry. Perhaps he does, but if we're talking about military commanders, well, they, of course, are all accountable to Gerasimov, who is the Chief of General Staff, who is in turn accountable to Putin, with whom he appears to have an excellent personal relationship, as revealed by the fact that Putin, when he addresses him, does so using first name and patronymic, which is in Russia a respectful but familiar form of address. So the idea of a military coup in Russia is bizarre. Such things have been attempted in Russia in the past. They have never succeeded. And it is inconceivable that Shoigu, of all people, would be the person behind a coup attempt today. So, again, there is no conceivable reality to any of this. As for the drone attacks, the scaling down of the Red Square parade on the 9th of May, also touched on in this program, in this report, well, I've already discussed that in previous programs. And as for the Prigozhin affair, the most important fact about the Prigozhin affair was that that coup attempt was not only unsuccessful, but collapsed almost immediately when it became clear that no official of the military or civilian system, governmental apparatus in Russia was prepared to support Prigozhin in his half-baked and disastrously ill-thought-out coup. There are, however, some facts buried inside this report which do have the ring of truth about them. The first is the actually not very extensive discussion of the Valdai attack. On the Duran, we have been almost alone. Gordon Hahn is another very important exception in talking about the significance of that attack in forming Russian thinking and Russian decision making about the progress of the conflict and the diplomacy and the relations with the United States. Now, as it happens, Putin has been the target of several assassination attempts organized by Ukraine. We know this because no less a person than Kirill Budanov, formerly head of Ukrainian military intelligence, now unhappily Zelensky's chief of staff, though my sense is that Budanov has no real control over Zelensky's staff, and the blogger who writes the blog Events in Ukraine says that the person who is really pulling the strings in amongst Zelensky's staff continues to be the previous ousted chief of staff, Andrei Yermak. Well, anyway, Budanov, about a year ago, as I remember, actually disclosed the fact that the Ukrainians have indeed made several attempts to assassinate Putin, though he said, regretfully, that obviously, given Putin, the fact that Putin is very much alive, all of these attempts have been unsuccessful. I have already said that one of these attacks, it seems to me, took place, one of these attempts took place in full public view. I think it was in June 2023 or thereabouts that a Ukrainian drone approached the Kremlin and was hovering above the dome of the Senate Palace where Putin has his office. The Russians brought the drone down using electronic jamming. But I said at the time that that looked to me like an attempt to launch a strike against Putin's office, perhaps in the hope that he would be there and that he might be killed. Well, that I think was possibly one such attack. Budanov has spoken of several, so clearly and obviously there have been others. And that, of course, goes far to explain the precautions under which Putin works, the fact that, as I said, he works now almost entirely from within the Kremlin. In my opinion, there is no doubt at all that the Valdai attack was another assassination attempt. Not only was it an attempt to attack the Valdai residence, which is, of course, a Russian presidential residence, which previously had been regularly used by Putin. I have no doubt that this is the case. And as I have pointed out in previous programs, many previous programs, including a program made at the time of the attack. The fact that this was an assassination attempt was all but confirmed by none other than Zelensky himself, when on Christmas Day he spoke to the Ukrainian people about how they all prayed for the death of one man who was obviously Vladimir Putin. So I've no doubt that that was an assassination attempt. The Russians, however, would have been particularly shocked by that assassination attempt because of the apparent involvement of the United States. The fact that the United States is known to provide the data that Ukraine uses in order to conduct its drone attacks inside Russia. This has been confirmed by the New York Times and also by the apparent role of the President of the United States, Donald Trump himself, conducting a telephone call to Putin, even as the attack was being prepared, telling Putin to remain where he was after the call ended, because Trump intended to confer with someone. From memory, I think it was none other than Zelensky himself. Therefore, keeping Putin in a place where the Ukrainians and Western intelligence would have reason to know where he was or believe where he was. And, well, it must have seemed to many people in Moscow, I'm going to make a guess, it must have seemed to virtually everybody in Moscow that Trump was setting up Putin for assassination, and that this is how the Valdai attack came about. It's been a striking fact that since that attack, there have been only two telephone conversations between Putin and Trump. Over the course of the first, which took place in March, shortly after the attack on Iran, Putin and Trump appear to have had a row about the attack on Iran, with causing the call to be described by Putin's aide, Ushakov, as frank, in other words, contentious. Whilst over the most recent call, the one that took place last week, which I have discussed in several programs and also now in a post on X, well, what that call was all about was Putin giving Trump a kind of cease and desist demand in relation to the conflict in Iran, warning Trump against resuming the conflict in Iran, against Iran, with the implication that Russia, as Iran's major military backer, would continue to provide assistance to Iran to counter that attack. So, compared with the previous intense discussions and meetings that had taken place between Putin and Trump last year, there's been a notable slackening in contacts between Putin and Trump this year. And as Alex Christoforou, I myself and Gordon Hahn have all discussed, the Valdai attack has had a significant chilling effect in relations between Moscow and Washington since it took place in December. So I think when this report says that this attack has been a factor in Russian calculations, I think that is true. But there is something else as well, which the report says, and this is the first I've heard about it, but I suspect that for once the report is publishing something which is true, and that is that there was apparently a deeply contentious meeting, a very angry meeting in the Kremlin, at some point over the last few months between the military and members of Russia's security agencies, following the assassination of an official of Russia's general staff, Lieutenant General Fanil Sarvarov, probably by Ukrainian agents, in fact, undoubtedly by Ukrainian agents, on the 22nd of December 2025. And apparently, the meeting took place 3 days after the assassination on the 25th of December 2025, which is worth saying is not celebrated in Russia as Christmas Day. But anyway, there was this meeting. It took place in the Kremlin, and apparently it was contentious. This is how CNN describes it. During the meeting, Chief of the General Staff, Valery Gerasimov, criticized the Federal Security Service, the FSB head, Alexander Bortnikov, for failing to protect his officers, who in turn, that's to say Bortnikov, complained of a lack of resources and personnel to do the job, emphasizing the fear and demoralization this had caused amongst military personnel. Gerasimov strongly criticized his counterparts in the special services for their lack of oversight. At the end of this tense meeting, Vladimir Putin called for calm, proposed an alternative working format, and instructed participants to present concrete solutions to the issue within that week, within 1 week. That quick solution involved Putin extending the reach of his own Federal Protection Service, the FSO, which at that time only protected Gerasimov in the military command, to provide security to 10 more senior commanders. Well, this makes complete sense, and it is consistent with something that I have spoken about myself in many programs, and that is my own bafflement that the Ukrainians were able to reach and assassinate senior military officials in Moscow without Russia's internal security agencies being able to take control or to get on top of this problem. And it looks as if the military had enough. Gerasimov complained to Putin. Putin, as he always does, called a meeting. The meeting got very heated. There was criticism of Bortnikov, the head of the FSB, Russia's counter-terrorist agency, because his agents were not successfully keeping successful track over Ukrainian agents. Bortnikov pushed back, and in the end, Putin exerted his authority, calmed everybody down, and eventually a solution was arrived at. Now, the thing to say about this is that this is almost certainly a genuine report about an actual meeting. It's probably the kind of report about which there's been much rumour in Moscow, and it's not difficult to imagine that a Western intelligence agency, say the British, would have got wind of it. And the description of the meeting is what one would expect. And it does provide, by the way, an explanation of why these assassinations have been so successful up to now. Because what this all points to is an overlap of conflicting agencies. So military officers, you would expect, would be protected by the military itself. However, the military in this case appears to have relied on the FSB, which is not a protection agency, but a counter-terrorism and internal security agency. So it's unsurprising that the cracks appeared between the military and the FSB, resulting in the fact that the officers were not properly protected. And it took Putin's personal decision to ensure that the FSO, Russia's equivalent of the US Secret Service, which, like the Secret Service, most emphatically is charged with providing bodyguard protection. It handles Putin's own security. That the FSO was given the task of providing protection, not just to Gerasimov, but to other senior Russian military officials as well. So this is consistent. What it shows, however, is not a Putin who is losing control or is about to lose control or is retreating into paranoia. It is a Putin in full control, restoring calm and ultimately steering the government towards a generally agreed solution. This report, in fact, contradicts the entire premise of this entire, of the entire content of the report as a whole. So why has this report appeared now? And that, for me, is far and away the most interesting fact about it. Why has it been drafted and written? And why has it been reported in the way that it has to the Western media? Now, you will not find any of those questions answered by the Financial Times, which is unsurprising and is something which further makes me think, is another reason why I tend to think that this report may have originated with a British intelligence agency. But by contrast, the CNN appears to be much more sceptical. It wonders whether, in fact, some of the point behind publication of this report might be because of a desire of a tendency to wishful thinking and of a need to undermine and destabilize the mood in the Kremlin. One of the points that CNN makes is that if there really were indications, for example, of a coup being prepared in the Kremlin, would the West, would a Western intelligence agency report that fact, alerting the Kremlin to the fact that such a coup was indeed being prepared? This is one quote from the CNN report. It is rare for Western intelligence agencies to leak detailed accounts of confidential deliberations by hostile actors, likely obtained from human or electronic sources, both of which risk compromise if exposed. Yet its release may reflect a bid by European officials to seize upon a hope that critics have argued has long been their sole strategy to defeat Russia in Ukraine, to wait for its internal collapse. Now, that is an extraordinary paragraph. Firstly, I'm going to say that in what it says, it is obviously, what it says here, it is obvious that that is true. Since the defeat of Ukraine's 2023 summer offensive, it's become absolutely clear that Ukraine will never defeat Russia, despite the many claims that you regularly see that that possibility still exists, and that the only way for Russia to be defeated is through an internal political crisis. I'm going to say that here things have gone full circle, because in my opinion, the whole point about the Ukrainian crisis in the first place was to trigger an internal crisis in Russia, leading to regime change and Putin's fall and his replacement by a more pro-Western, or at any rate much weaker, government. Now, what we see is that because that has not happened, and because the war in Ukraine is being lost, the West, or Western intelligence agencies, or European officials, or perhaps specifically British officials, now see what was originally the objective, regime change in Moscow, as the solution to their current crisis, the likely future defeat of Ukraine, and by extension of the collective West. So they want to see regime change in Moscow. They want a political crisis in Moscow. They were hoping, I am sure, that the Prigozhin affair back in 2023 would deliver it. I discussed at the time that there was good reason to think that Prigozhin had indeed been in contact, at least with the Ukrainians, and that some information about this, probably more than some, a lot of information about this, was circulating in the West. And, well, that hope still flickers as everything else goes dark. Negotiation with the Russians is impossible. We cannot make any concessions to the Russians. Let's keep our fingers crossed. Let's hope that something in Moscow goes wrong, that there is a political crisis. And if there is a political crisis, well, we will have won after all. European officials seize upon a hope. Notice the word hope and seizing upon a hope that critics have argued has long been their sole strategy to defeat Russia in Ukraine, to wait for its internal collapse. That is their only strategy. You read that in CNN. They no longer really believe that military defeat is possible. They have no plan, no strategy for victory. They have no plan or strategy for diplomatic engagement. All they can think of, all they can do, is to hold out, tell themselves and each other that if they tighten up sanctions a little bit more here, if they disrupt maritime, Russian maritime trade a little bit more there, if they carry out a few more drone attacks on a few more Russian refineries, if they spread stories about the stalemate supposedly taking place in the front lines, if they spread more stories about internal coups in Russia, about Putin losing the support of the Russian population, well, then, in that case, eventually, if they can hold out long enough, that longed for, deeply desired internal crisis will arise, and everything the West wanted and expected, those things that they talked about in gleeful anticipation with each other at the Munich Security Conference in February 2022, all of those things will finally come to pass. Where the plan was once glowing with anticipation and hope, you can see that it has now become a plan based instead on desperation. Everything has failed, but we must keep on with it, because it's our only chance now. It's our only strategy. We truly, genuinely, honestly have nothing else. And I'm going to suggest that all of this explains much of the narrative we've heard over the last few weeks. The stories about stalemate on the front lines, of record Russian losses, of the Russians making no progress in the war, of a budgetary crisis, of a financial crisis inside Russia, of the economy going off the rails, of Putin's popularity collapsing, all of these things. Clearly, it's obvious to me, reading these two articles in the Financial Times and in CNN, that what we have seen has been the fruit of an actual, sustained, organised campaign to get this idea of an internal crisis in Russia out there, in the hope that if you do get it out there, well, through some mysterious alchemy, through some strange, never fully explained process, well, it will all actually come to pass. And some of the evidence that is proposed or provided for all of this is incredibly threadbare. The claim that Shoigu is the likely organizer of the coup is one. And, well, references which have appeared all over the media that some sort of social media personality has supposedly publicly criticized Putin, even though when I actually read her comment, I couldn't really see myself that she said anything unusual or extraordinary, and anything that she has not said before. So there it is. The sole strategy is to wait for regime change in Moscow, to try to make it happen. That's why there's the attacks on the refineries. That's why there's the harassment of the Russian ships. That's why we hear all of these stories about stalemate in the war. It's not a strategy at all. It's a hope, as CNN itself says, a fantasy, if I have to be honest, a mirage, if you prefer. But that's all the West has now. Well, let me just make a few quick observations. Firstly, on the situation in the economy, we've had a lot of further news as it happens over the last 48 hours. Firstly, as I discussed in my program yesterday, there has been a significant rebound in the Russian economy in March. And in fact, some of the earlier figures for January and February have been revised. So the January contraction was not 2.2%, it was 1.8%. The February contraction was less. With the rebound in March, the overall contraction of GDP contraction of the Russian economy in the first quarter was -0.3. Not so much a contraction, rather a state of stagnation, a state of stasis, with, however, signs of some kind of revival starting to take place. Looking back, I suspect that what happened was that in January, with the VAT increase, the VAT increase coming, consumers cut back heavily on spending. They cut back more on spending than perhaps the Russian authorities had anticipated. And the result was the significantly higher than expected GDP contraction in that month. But then, as it became clear that the VAT increase was a one-off and that the overall trend in prices continues to be gradually downward from the 2024 peaks, consumer confidence recovered, people started buying again, and the result has been the GDP recovery that we are looking at now. With inflation continuing to come down, and it is likely it will come down faster over the next few months as we approach the spring and summer period, when in Russia inflation tends to fall, we are likely to see interest rates fall further, and all of that points to a continuing and strong recovery. We are more likely to see growth perhaps at around 1.5% in the year overall. Certainly not dramatic, but certainly not a recession either. And it is likely that by the end of the year, growth will have picked up significantly and will be higher in 2027. Well, that's the actual situation in the economy. As for the budget, we don't have full figures, but the Russian finance minister, Siluanov, says that excess budgetary receipts in March, sorry, in April, from higher energy exports, increased energy exports following the Strait of Hormuz crisis, that the extra budget income receipts that went to the budget came to around $2.6 billion, which almost exactly equals the size of Russia's deficit in March. So at the moment, we are looking at a deficit in January and February with reasons to think that we're going to see a further recovery in budgetary receipts over the course of the rest of the year, certainly the spring, summer, autumn months. And all of this points to a situation of economic stability overall, of prices gradually coming down, of interest rates gradually coming down, of overall recovery, and certainly not the financial crisis that some people in the Western media have been excitedly talking about over the last few weeks. What about the situation on the front lines? Well, there, as it happens, we have had quite a lot of information. I've discussed recently, in recent programs, the situation in Konstantinovka, where, in my opinion, the main battle continues to take place. Our old friend, Denis Pushilin, has been talking about the situation in Konstantinovka. He said that in the Konstantinovka direction, we see better positions allowing our forces to start a broader development of Konstantinovka after Ilinovka and Novodmitrovka have been liberated. Being aware of the collapse of its defense in Konstantinovka, the Ukrainians are trying to withdraw their officers from Konstantinovka. And so far, supposedly, they have been unsuccessful. Circumstances where the Ukrainians start pulling senior officers, and I think we must mean here senior officers, from positions in cities, speak of a cauldron emerging. I've already discussed in several places that it looks to me as this, the situation in Konstantinovka is developing rapidly towards a cauldron. Reading between the lines of what Pushilin is saying, it could be that the cauldron in Konstantinovka has already formed. Pushilin also speaks about the Russians having successfully established control of the eastern part of the village of Rai Alexandrovka to the east of Kramatorsk. This is the village that is on the hill that looks down on Kramatorsk itself, but more importantly, looks down on the supply roads and road connections that link Kramatorsk to Druzhivka and Konstantinovka in the south and Slavyansk to the north. It seems to me that we are coming ever closer to the situation not just of a cauldron in Konstantinovka, but of a bigger cauldron in the Slavyansk Kramatorsk conurbation altogether. And of course, there's been ample news about the situation. In the sky, there's been lots of reports about Russian drones. I should say that every day now, every day and every night, Russian Garand drones now operate above the skies of Ukraine. There's reports about how they're now attacking gas stations, petrol stations, places where people tank up for fuel for their cars. Anyway, apparently the Russians are attacking these, which suggests, by the way, an amplitude of Garand drones, if they can attack such relatively small targets. But anyway, this is taking place all the time. I discussed the recent web of interconnections between the way in which the various drones now talk with each other, the rumours that the Russians have established some kind of control system in Belarus, which enables the Russians to control drone operations directly above Kiev and west of Kiev. And of course, at some point, perhaps already, the Russians are going to bring their own Starlink analog satellite system in operation. And that's going to be working busily as well. So all of this is going on the military front lines. And, well, we have the United States bogged down and distracted by the conflict with the Iranians. And here I will say a few things about this latest verbal spat between the Iranians and the Americans. So President Trump, unsurprisingly, has again spoken about the fact that he's very unhappy, very dissatisfied that the Iranians continue to make demands of him instead of capitulating to the demands that he makes of them. And without providing any details or explanations as to how supposedly it is going to be done, he says he has said recently that the US Navy is going to manage some kind of mechanism, some undisclosed mechanism, to get ships to pass safely through the Strait of Hormuz, breaking what is in effect an Iranian blockade of the Strait of Hormuz. And the Iranians, for their part, have ridiculed these comments of Trump. They say that the United States has no means, no way of breaking the Iran's control of the Strait of Hormuz. And the Iranians have made claims of their own, that they've launched missile strikes on some kind of US Navy warship. And supposedly those missiles impacted on that warship, though shortly after the Pentagon denied that those reports were true. There's far too much coverage of all of this in the media, in my opinion. Far too much analysis out there of this story. By now, people ought to be used to the fact that Donald Trump says all sorts of things about the Strait of Hormuz, none of which actually comes to pass. Coming up with some new proclamation that the Strait of Hormuz is going to be reopened without providing any explanation at all of how that is to be done is par for the course for him. And as for the Iranians, well, of course, they make all kinds of threats and make all kinds of statements, obviously intended to keep tankers from approaching the Strait of Hormuz. And in that, by the way, putting aside the truth or falsity of their claims to have struck US Navy ships with missiles, all of these threats are indeed effective. The ships, the tankers, so far, unwilling, extremely unwilling to try to challenge the Iranians in the Strait of Hormuz. So, anyway, the United States bogged down in all of this. The United States, as I discussed in a recent program, effectively stopping deliveries of critical weapons to the Europeans, including for onward transmission by the Europeans to Ukraine, because the Americans are now critically short of the same weapons for themselves. They've already used up a large part of their stockpiles over the last 4 years, supplying the Iranians, sorry, the Ukrainians, and now, having fought for 40 days from against the Iranians, they are shorter, much shorter still. So the Americans running down, closing down their arms deliveries to the Europeans, the United States now pulling troops out of Europe, 5,000, we're told, will leave this year, and I believe that Donald Trump is talking about withdrawing still more. So, dwindling support from the Americans for Ukraine, the Europeans having problems of their own. Chancellor Merz has just delivered another extraordinary interview saying that Germany doesn't have enough engineers, it's got too many lawyers. He himself, of course, is a lawyer, as he rather shamefacedly pointed out, and that means that whereas Germany could once build railways, and China today builds railways at extraordinary speed, now it has problems building a small bypass. All of which, by the way, is true, and all of which is also true to an even greater extent in Britain, but I'm not going to dwell on that. Anyway, the Europeans, facing all of these problems, looking at the prospect of a severe recession as oil and energy is in increasing short supply, a recession that is inevitably going to worsen by far the existing budgetary crisis that all European governments face. The British authorities, according to reports in the British media today, have basically told the Royal Navy and apparently other sections of the British military that despite the increase in defence spending, the military and the Navy in particular should not expect any new equipment to be delivered to them before 2030 at the earliest. In other words, in 4 years' time. So, this is the country Britain, which is taking on Russia, Germany as well. We just heard what Chancellor Merz said. These countries in no position to continue to help Ukraine, to continue to provide military aid to Ukraine at the level needed to be able to hold the Russians back. The Europeans will continue to provide money. And by the way, a member of the Durand community very kindly passed on to me a media report of which I was completely unaware, that Keir Starmer, our increasingly hapless Prime Minister, well, he still cares about one thing, and he still has some authority in relation to it in Britain. Apparently, he has decided that Britain will also contribute a sum to the 90 billion euro loan that the European Union is making to Ukraine. So the 90 billion euro loan is no longer just a European Union loan. It is becoming, through some mysterious, magical, undiscussed, undebated process in Britain, an EU-British loan. The exact size of the British contribution is not being disclosed in this article. But then in Britain, there is hardly any commentary about the exact level of help that Britain gives to Ukraine, which I put at a minimum at £5 billion a year. So the British chipping in, giving money they don't have, and depriving their own people in order to support Ukraine, but unable to provide weapons. I don't get the sense that anybody in Europe really is in much of a position to provide weapons to Ukraine. The Americans, distracted, worried about China, worried about the Middle East, everybody worrying about the surge in energy prices, the situation on the front lines in Ukraine getting worse and worse, the situation in the Ukrainian economy getting worse. I don't place any weight at all on Ukrainian economic statistics, but such as they are, they point to a widening budget deficit, an increase in inflation, which is now firmly in double figures, and, well, lower than expected GDP growth. And of course, when we talk about GDP growth in Ukraine, what that means is less money being sent to Ukraine by the West, which inflates Ukrainian GDP growth. Apparently, having recently decided to continue to support Ukraine, the IMF is reverting to some doubts and perhaps is less enthusiastic about supporting Ukraine than it was. Though, as is always the way with the IMF, I have no doubt that in one way or the other, in some form or another, they will give Ukraine more money. And of course, there are still the puff pieces. There's a long article today in the London Times about the Ukrainian factory making missiles that can reach Moscow. The factory belongs to a company called Firepoint. The entire article is a massive puff piece, actually, about this company, about Firepoint. Nowhere in the article is there an admission that the company is deeply controversial in Ukraine, that it is in fact co-owned by Mr. Mindich, the person at the center of the corruption scandal in Ukraine, the person who has recently been disclosed as being in close contact with Rustem Umerov, the former Ukrainian defense minister, who's now Ukraine's chief negotiator, and who is the secretary of Ukraine's Supreme National National Defense and Security Council, and who is a close Zelensky ally. I discussed the shady stories involving this company in my program yesterday. But anyway, the Times gives the company a puff piece. You can read it if you want. in the London Times. So I suppose that's a kind of support for Zelensky and Ukraine at this particular time. Anyway, so we have all of that, but none of this resolves the underlying problems, the deepening crisis in Ukraine itself. There is no strategy, as CNN tells us, to win the war against Russia, other than to wait and hope for the day when there will be a political crisis in Moscow and do whatever can be done, however ineffective it is, to get that crisis to happen. And in the meantime, more Ukrainians die. Shortages of infantry on the front lines become more visible. I've said already that, in my opinion, the reason why the Russians are able to capture territory in the north of Ukraine, in Sumy region and in Kharkiv region so quickly, is almost certainly because the Ukrainian forces in this area are very few in number, and though the Russian forces belonging to group of forces north are probably not there in huge numbers either, the Russians are able nonetheless to walk into villages and supposedly strategic locations, which, because of shortages of manpower, the Ukrainians have left undefended. So you have no war-winning strategy. Your methods of economic coercion have failed. Your hope of an economic crisis in Russia this year is proving to be a mirage. But cling on as long as you can to this idea that there's going to be an internal crisis in Russia. Overinterpret a story about a debate within the Kremlin about what steps to take to better protect senior army officers from Ukrainian organized assassination attempts as a crisis, and keep your fingers crossed. This, in the middle of the worst crisis that the collective West has faced since the end of the Second World War. And I say that without any hesitation whatsoever. If you think about it, it is actually incredible. I have been complaining for years about the utter bankruptcy of Western and specifically European diplomacy in the face of this crisis. But however bad things get, and they're getting very bad indeed, they're getting very bad for Ukraine, and they're getting very bad for Europe too, and even more so for the European publics, however bad it gets, we just carry on. We carry on and we hope, because that is all we have. Well, I am not a person inclined at all to mysticism. I do not believe that simply because I want something or hope for something, it must happen. The idea that you can conduct foreign policy and defence policy and security policy in the middle of a conflict, an armed conflict, in which, however indirectly, you are a major party on a wing and a prayer, is something totally incomprehensible to me. And yet, we've seen from these articles in the Financial Times and CNN that is all the West, or at least the Europeans, have. And for the record, I express my relief and thanks that the people who wrote that article in CNN and the editors see it also. Well, this is where I'm going to finish today's program. Let me remind you again that you can find all our programs on all our platforms, Locals, Rumble, X and Substack. You can support our work via Patreon and Subscribestar and by going to our shop, links under this video. Last but not least, if you've liked this video, please remember to tick the like button and to check your subscription to this channel. That's me for today. More from me soon. Have a very good day.